Well, good morning. I don't know if this is a spring day or a fall day. Wisconsin is really fooling us. I have a rose that's blooming this morning, if you can imagine, in my garden. It doesn't know what season it is either. Anyway, it's very lovely. Before we call the first case for today, my notes tell me that we have some students from Horning Middle School, and if they're here, would they please stand? Oh, wonderful. What a nice group. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that the Supreme Court operates in coordination with the state bars called Court with Class. So they get information about the case that you are both going to argue to us today and have some opportunity to discuss how the Supreme Court operates with the justice after the second argument this morning. So today, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, if you can come back, we'll talk with you a little bit about what goes on procedurally with the Supreme Court, and I think you'll find it very interesting. It depends on what your schedules are, I know, for buses. So we've seen a little bit of you, and there are many of you, which is wonderful. I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her is a chair where Justice Annette Ziegler generally sits. She is not participating in this case, so she won't be out today. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, as I've introduced her before, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. In the chair in the middle is Justice Michael Gableman. He is participating, and I'm expecting he will come into the courtroom momentarily. And on my far left, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with all of those introductions, we'll call our first case, Voces de la Frontera versus David Clark. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Oyvind Wistrom with Lindner and Marzak of Milwaukee, and I represent the petitioner, Milwaukee County Sheriff David A. Clark, in this matter. This case involves an open records request made under the Wisconsin Public Records Law for the production of 12 I-247 forms that were provided to Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which is a component of the Department of Homeland Security. The forms that were provided to Milwaukee County each relates to a specific inmate or immigrant who was in custody of Milwaukee County that ICE believed was potentially illegally here in the United States and was subject to deportation. The form, the I-247 form, then allowed Milwaukee County Sheriff and Sheriff Clark to hold that individual for an additional 48 hours after the individual would otherwise have been released on state charges. And the reason for that hold was to allow ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, the opportunity to take that individual into custody to then proceed with immigration enforcement proceedings, including potential deportation.
Counsel, what happens if, by error, this person is not detained as requested?
Well, the request to detain is discretionary on behalf of the local law enforcement agency.
That is, the local enforcement agency has discretion whether to adhere to it. Is that what you're telling me?
That is correct, okay. Your Honor.
So it's a request, not an order.
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, is any response given to ICE upon receipt of a 247 form? That is to say, does the Sheriff's Office ever respond to the ICE saying, we will honor the request or we will not honor the request?
Yeah, there is a response. Once Milwaukee County or the local law enforcement agency receives the form from the federal government, there's two things that ICE requests happen. One is they want the local law enforcement agency to notify ICE of when the individual is scheduled to be released. So there is a notification that goes back to the federal government. And secondly is the request then to detain the person for the additional 48 hours after the person is otherwise would otherwise be released. Now, Sheriff Clark has a practice and has had a practice of honoring these requests for detainer. So an individual who is in custody, who is subject to a federal detainer hold Sheriff Clark will honor that request and hold the individual for the 48 hours to allow ICE to come in to take custody of the individual.
Counsel, when you say subject to, does that mean that not yet in federal custody, but subject to being in the future in federal custody?
Yeah, the individual, while, bless you, Your Honor, while they're in being held by the local law enforcement agency before the 48-hour kicks in, the individual is, in fact, in state custody. There's no dispute that they remain in state custody during that period of time.
In fact, that was my next question. Both paragraph 25 and paragraph 28, and I think elsewhere in the Court of Appeals opinion, states, it's undisputed that Sheriff Clark held the jail prisoners in state custody and that custody had not expired at the time of the open records request. That appears to still be your position. Is that correct?
It is not. That statement by the Court of Appeals is factually baseless.
Okay, how about the statement in paragraph 28 that they make? The sheriff does not dispute the fact that the prisoners in question here were held on state charges which had not expired. Are they wrong on that paragraph also?
They are, Your Honor.
And tell me how they're wrong.
Well, I think the easiest way to think about it, there's three different distinct periods of time that we're dealing with. One is before the 48-hour period kicks in. Okay, during that period of time, they are in state custody. There's no dispute about that. Once their second period of time is during the 48-hour period where they're being held on behalf of the federal government. They would otherwise be released. The third period is after they're then released from the local law enforcement, taken custody by ICE, and then either deported or taken into custody somewhere else. The 12 individuals at issue here, the request covered a period of time from November 20th, 2014 to February 5th of 2015, so about 3 months. There is no evidence in the record that the 12 individuals were still in state custody at the time.
And so it's your position that Judge Brennan, when she wrote the opinion and looked at the briefs, did you have oral argument in this?
We did not, Judge.
And looked at the briefs, that she misread your briefs and your position stated in your briefs. Is that your position? Because she says it, I quoted twice, but there's one other place in the opinion where she essentially says the same thing, that it's not disputed.
There was little evidence taken at the trial court level as to what stage of the proceedings those 12 individuals were in at the time. But record number 6 in the record are the actual redacted forms. And on the bottom, it demonstrates when the person was, in fact, released from state custody, held by on behalf of ICE, and then subsequently released. In actuality, of the 12 individuals, 6 of the people had been held for a period of 48 hours and released by the time the open records request was made. Now, there's two different periods when the ICE 247 form is received by Milwaukee County. There's no dispute that the 12 individuals were in state custody. But at the time that the open records request was made, some were still in state custody and some had been held for the 48 hours and then released to ICE by the time the open records request had been made.
In fact, ICE doesn't hold people in custody in Milwaukee, do they? I think they have these federal places like Dodge or something.
I don't think it's in Milwaukee. I'm not certain here.
Well, but that was not the explanation given by the records custodian, that they were in the 48 hours or had already been released to the feds. That isn't any. The records custodian is supposed to tell the records requester why they're not giving out the record, right? That's one under the statute, isn't that right?
And the timing of this case, unfortunately, didn't allow the records custodian that opportunity, because before the documents were produced to VOSIS, a lawsuit was filed, a writ of mandamus, to seek the production of those documents.
I know, but how many weeks, months passed between the request and the response?
There was some initial delays because the initial request was much broader. It was narrowed, and the prepayment of $300 for the cost was made on March 11th. The production was to be made on April 8th. The lawsuit was filed on April 1st.
And when was the request made?
The request was made on February 5th.
February 5th, 2015. Okay. As of February 5, 2015, was everyone in state custody? Which period of time was there? You have three periods.
Yeah. At the time...
All the 12 before 48 hours?
As of February 2nd, 2015,
yep.
Six of the individuals were still in state custody.
Okay.
Six individuals had been held for the 48-hour period and then subsequently released to
okay.
the federal government.
Six were in the 48 hours. Okay. So if you looked at the record request and you looked at the individuals involved, you could tell whether they were in the 48-hour period or they were not, right?
By looking at the ICE form itself, the
I-4247? Well, looking at the records in the Milwaukee County Jail.
Sure, you could find that information.
That's right. So, but they didn't explain that's why they were not releasing the records of six people, right?
Well, ultimately, as a form of compromise, after a hearing was held in front of Circuit Court Judge Borowski, the decision was made to produce redacted copies of the forms, of all 12 of the forms.
And they did not tell the Circuit Court judge that which time period was involved and why they were objecting to releasing it.
I wasn't participating in the case, Your Honor, at that point, but I don't believe that was an issue that was addressed at the Circuit
okay.
Court level.
So all I'm trying to say is that the record custodian is supposed to explain why they are not releasing the records. Because that triggers whether or not they're going to get sued. If you don't give me a good reason, I'm going to sue you, right?
Correct.
If you give me a good reason, then I run a risk of losing a lawsuit, right? So that's the whole point of getting the record custodian, to give reasons, right?
Sure.
So that you know, the requester knows. And that's not a reason you've given. It's not a reason that was given at the Court of Appeals, and it's the first time it's given is here.
Well,
have you forfeited it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
The argument relating to the application of 8 CFR 236.6, which I think is central to this case, was raised at the Court of Appeals level. The argument was made by VOSAS before the Court of Appeals that argument was waived. We responded to that argument, and the Court of Appeals held that the principle is that you can't raise new issues on appeal, but you can raise a new argument on appeal that wasn't raised before. So we took the position, Milwaukee County Sheriff took the position at the Circuit Court, that the documents should not be produced. The fact that a new legal basis or argument to support that conclusion was made at the Court of Appeals, the court concluded is reasonable.
I know.
Counsel, let's concentrate a little
bit. You didn't raise the factual issue. There's a legal issue as to the interpretation of this regulation. That's what you raised at the Court of Appeals. That's what you're raising here, and I think you should be heard on that, and the court should make a decision on that. But you're now raising a factual issue.
Well, the record six, which are the redacted forms, does contain some information concerning the status of some of the individuals.
So you expect the court to figure it out, but your record custodian did not, and lawyer did not.
Counsel, can we talk a little bit about the application of 8 CFR section 236.6? The regulation speaks in terms of federal detainees. When does a person become a federal detainee?
Well, formally taken into custody by the federal government occurs after the expiration of the 48 hours. But I think the focus on whether the person's in state custody or federal custody is improper. The statute or the regulation itself doesn't address whether the person's in state custody or federal custody. It simply provides that any entity that houses, maintains, provides service to, or otherwise holds an individual on behalf of the service, on behalf of ICE, so whether they're in state custody or federal custody doesn't determine whether or not the application of this regulation applies.
Right. It's what determines it is whether that entity or person is providing any of those services on behalf of the service with respect to a particular detainee.
They're holding or providing a service on behalf of ICE, correct.
Okay.
And it's...
Is it with respect to that specific detainee or is it just the general proposition that this is the type of entity that provides those kinds of services on behalf of ICE?
I believe it relates to the specific detainee in question.
Okay. So with respect to when we look at the application of 236.6, do we have to look at whether the sheriff's office was providing those kinds of services with respect to each of those identified people in the 247s before we look at whether 236.6 applies?
Potentially. I think ultimately the same conclusion must be reached regardless of what stage in the process they are. And if I could explain.
And if you could concentrate on why 236.6 would be applicable before the person is being transferred to federal custody with respect to that 48-hour hold.
Sure. Thank you, Judge. The Court of Appeals assumed that all of the individuals were still in state custody. The court didn't specifically address each of the three periods of time, but I think it's very clear that during the 48 hours that the person is being held on behalf of ICE, the individual would have been otherwise released. The only reason they're still in custody, albeit state custody, is because of the request from ICE. After the 48-hour period, the rule should still apply. There's a couple cases. In fact, the Commissioner of Corrections Freedom of Information case from the Connecticut Supreme Court specifically says that nothing in the language of the regulation differentiates between information about detainees who have been transferred to the custody of another governmental entity and information about detainees who have been released altogether. So the fact that they are released and in federal custody or have been deported and are out of the country doesn't defeat the fact that they're still, the information is still protected under 236.6.
So is that because 236.6 applies even prior to that 48-hour period?
We believe it does, Your Honor.
Tell me why it applies prior to that 48-hour period.
The regulation is written very, very broadly. Again, it uses the terms houses, maintains, provides service to, or otherwise holds a detainee. And as soon as the detention form is received by Milwaukee County, there is essentially a joint, the reason they're being maintained, we believe the term maintain is broad enough to include that period of time, because during the period before they're technically held on behalf of ICE, they're being maintained in state custody in order to subsequently be taken in to custody by ICE and to be held for those 48 hours.
How do we know that's the case? Is there anything to indicate that Sheriff Clark said, yes, when the period of detention under state law ends, we will hold this person for the extra 48 hours?
I believe by responding to the form and providing that form back to ICE, he's essentially saying, yes, I will honor the request. The person's being released, and we will hold the person on your behalf.
So under that theory, are you saying that there are two sovereigns at work simultaneously in maintaining custody, or at least maintaining that detainee? One sovereign on behalf of people of Wisconsin, the other sovereign on behalf of the people of the United States.
I believe the person, yes, is being maintained in custody in furtherance of the Immigration Enforcement Agency's request to hold that person for the 48 hours. So even though the 48 hours hasn't formally kicked in yet, they're still maintaining that individual in custody so they can be subsequently taken into custody by ICE. And I think if you analyze this, if that isn't the outcome of this case, then it makes no logical sense for the information on these forms to be protected during the 48 hours and after they're released into the custody of ICE, but it's not protected before the 48-hour kicks in. That would mean that these forms, which contain confidential and personally identifiable information about inmates, is protected once the 48-hour starts, but not beforehand. Well, the form is the same. The information on the form is the same, whether it's before the 48-hour starts or after the 48 hours.
But, counsel, 236.6, the CFR section at issue here, expressly prohibits a state or local government entity or anyone from disclosing the name of or other information relating to the detainee, but here the names were released. So does that undercut your argument at all that the information to be protected under 236 was not protected in this instance.
And under 236.6, we believe it should have been protected. The decision was made to provide the redacted forms. Again, that was after this lawsuit was filed. It was in chambers with a judge as a form of compromise. But ultimately, if this court agrees that 236.6 applies to these forms, then they should not have been produced at all, which would include the names, the dates of birth, and the other information about the information that was not redacted. That information should not have been produced.
All right, Mr. Wistrom, prior to any information being released to Voces de la Frontera, there was a consultation with legal counsel for ICE, is that correct?
There were two separate, consultations with two different representatives from ICE.
All right, and did ICE tell the sheriff's office you cannot release any information on these records pursuant to 8 CFR section 236.6?
They were not provided with that advice, no. The advice they received was certain specific information on the form should be redacted, and here are the reasons why under federal law and under FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, ICE believed the information was should be protected.
But then it doesn't appear that ICE was applying 236.6 to these forms because they okayed the release of the names, among other arguably personally identifiable information.
It appears that way. 236.6 is a relatively obscure provision, and why it wasn't relied upon at the trial court level, I'm not sure. But I think it clearly applies to the facts of this case.
But not just at the trial court level. ICE itself was not applying 236, or were they? I mean, is there some exception that would allow the release of the names? Do you have any, is there anything in the record that explains why ICE okayed the release of the names, notwithstanding 236.6?
Well, the information provided from ICE was actually that some more information should have been redacted. And I think that included the identity of the individuals and the dates of birth. But ultimately, the balancing test that the custodian undertook, she made the decision to release that information because Milwaukee County Sheriff and the Milwaukee County Sheriff's website, as well as CCAP, contains information about the individuals. So somebody can go on, it's public information, somebody can go on and see if somebody is in custody in Milwaukee County. So the custodian didn't feel it was appropriate to redact that information. So it was produced.
But with respect to the name and the information that is included in the immigration detainer form, there's information that 236.6 would protect that was in fact disclosed. And I think it was under ICE's advice that the records custodian release the names. I thought that was not part of the balancing test. I thought that was specific to ICE's advice and counsel on what could be disclosed.
At the time that the initial open records request was filed, ICE did not recommend that no information be provided in accordance with 236.6.
You had a couple knots in there. Could you clarify, please?
At the time the open records request, ICE didn't tell Milwaukee County Sheriffs don't produce them because 236.6 applies.
Okay.
That's the point you're trying to make.
Yes, yeah, ICE was not applying 236 when they were advising the records custodian.
At that time, they were not.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, there's an Exhibit 2 in the record from Bilke Brandon, who was with ICE. And it just says that he is going to work with his counterparts and forward information to further advise. No such information was given. Is that what you're telling us?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor.
Okay,
the initial request is dated March 31st from Mr. Bilke. He indicates that further information was going to be requested.
That's right. That's what I was just looking at.
And then Record 14, page 2 and 3, is an April 3rd, 2015 email from Charlotte Lavelle. Charlotte is with
Go ahead.
She's with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, out of Washington, D.C.
Right. And
so that's dated April 3rd. She provided additional information concerning.
What'd she say?
It's approximately a two-page email, but it goes into, primarily focuses on the FOIA exceptions under B7C and B7E that the information is either private and contains law enforcement-sensitive information that could potentially disclose the proceedings or the procedures that, that ICE uses.
Did you tell them not to release anything?
She did not.
Okay. Counsel, I have that in front of me as Exhibit 4, and there's no reference to 236 whatsoever, is there, that I saw in this?
I don't believe
it.
There is.
It's all FOIA, as I see it. Is that correct?
That's correct.
One other thing, I want to make sure we get this out of dispute, if it indeed is out of dispute. Are you disputing that the immigration documents are records under the open records law?
We are not disputing that.
So you.
Mr.
You're not Wisdom. Disputing it, given the statement in the open records law that refers to laws of the federal government? You don't think that fits within that statement?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah. Just so I'm clear on your answer to Justice Bradley, you are not disputing that the Form 247, as controlled, you say, by 236.6, is not a document that is precluded because of its connection with law enforcement under the Wisconsin public records law.
There is an exception for intergovernmental documents. We do not believe it applies or fits into that exception.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Counsel, the Section 236.6 says, insofar as any documents or other records contain such information, such documents shall not be public records. Does that not supersede Section 19.36 of our statutes with respect to what is a public record?
Well, it's a record under the statute, but the application of 236.6, which is enforced, it is applicable here because of 19.36.1 that specifically says if precluded by federal law, and we believe that, that this is precluded by federal law, so it's not a public record and it should not have been produced.
Okay. So then the sentence that follows that, could you help me understand the temporal aspect of that sentence? It says, this section applies to all persons and information identified or described in it, regardless of when such persons obtained such information. Who is the person that that clause refers to? What is the significance of the section applying without respect to when that person obtains the information?
Well, I think the person is the entity that's holding the detainee on behalf or providing the service. So it would be the local law enforcement agency. So I think it supports our conclusion or our belief that this applies before the 48-hour period as well as during and after it, because it doesn't matter when the entity, when the person received that information. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Attorney Earl, the podium goes up and down, so please make it comfortable for you, because otherwise we can't hear very well in this room. See if that, how that works, microphone-wise.
Sometimes I feel taller than I am.
That's okay. It's not your height. It's the voice in this room. It doesn't carry very well. Thank you.
If it pleases this honorable court, good morning. My name is Peter Earl, and I represent Voces de la Frontera and Christine Newman Ortiz, who is present in court with me here today. If this court would allow me, I'd like to contextualize this dispute. Put it in the real life reality from whence it was born. And according to the testimony of Christine Newman Ortiz during the hearing at the trial court on May 6, 2015, she said, and this is undisputed on the record, that Voces de la Frontera has a major concern about the manner in which Sheriff Clark participates in the ICE deportation process. From Voss's perspective and the perspective of the Latino community at large, It is very harmful to everybody in society to entangle local law enforcement in the deportation process.
Counsel, just to make sure that we get to the issues we need to cover today, isn't our obligation to assume that VOCES has a good and proper purpose for requesting the information?
I'm sorry, Justice Kelly.
I'll do that again. Isn't it our obligation to assume that VOCES has a good and proper purpose for requesting the information?
Yes, but that was challenged by Sheriff Clark in his briefs before this court, sure. Saying...
But that's no part of our analysis.
I believe that you're correct, Your Honor, I'll dispense with the rest of it.
Well, what about the public policy? Have to advocate the public policy here is, well, they have to advocate that there is not a good enough public policy.
Right, because what we have here we have the blue sky public policy, which is a legislative mandate to this court to interpret the open records law as expansively as permissively possible. And this doesn't work very well.
That's the public policy.
As expansively as possible, which means that the exceptions to that policy should be construed as narrowly as possible so as to allow the citizenry the fullest opportunity to know what their government is doing.
Counsel, could you just assume for the sake of argument that we find 236.6 does apply? Just assume that. If we find that, does that trump state law, or does state law supersede federal law?
Absolutely. If this court were to find that 236.6 applies, we're dead in the water. Okay? It absolutely would preempt state law. It would do it through a mechanism contained within the open records statute, which is this, what I refer to as the pass-through provision, which says that anything that is explicitly prohibited from disclosure from other laws, those Wisconsin honors that and applies that. So in effect, there's a pass-through that through which that preemption would trap, Your Honor.
And Mr. Earle, one of the sticking points that I had when I was preparing for this case is the idea, and it seemed to me both parties recognized the principle that if these 12 individuals were being held on the federal detention, then the documents that your client was seeking would not be released and would be properly denied. Am I right so far?
Yes, I think. But let me frame it so I make I'm because it, there's.
Let me let you know where I'm going with
okay.
this before. It's a pretty simple idea.
Yeah.
So what kept coming back to me was, well, if the county detention, either sentence or other detention, ends on Friday, and if that ends on Friday, and your client happens to get their public records request in on Friday, then the document is released. But if the federal detention starts on Monday, and your client doesn't get it in until Monday, then the document is properly withheld. And I kept going around thinking, well, that's a little bit like the tail wagging the dog. And either the contents of the document are properly withheld or they're not, regardless of whether the request comes in on Friday or whether it comes in on Monday. And we're all trying to look in, and I had my law clerks looking in, what is contained? And I know from your questioning of Captain Trewicki, you kept trying to get information about what is so special about the information on this form. So help me out with this idea that we should be bound by whether the request comes in on Friday or Monday.
Well, Your Honor, the paradigm set up by your question kind of focuses, I think.
But
that's
the paradigm that the parties, that's the framework that the briefs are written in.
But if federal law does not apply, it does not apply. If these detainees, these prisoners, are not in federal custody, they are not prisoners of the federal government, then 236.6 does not apply.
I have a lot to say about that, but
I want to come back to Justice Abramson's policy question because I think it has something to do.
This is rather important as a factual matter, and Justice Gableman is raising it. As I hear his question to you, it is, if the person is in state custody, then point six, federal regulation can be read that it's only a request and that you are entitled to the record. As the counsel for Mr. Clark, Sheriff Clark, stated, there are three periods of time: before the 48 hours, during the 48 hours, and after the 48 hours. Do you agree that those are three relevant times?
I do, but I'd like to elaborate on that, Your Honor, if I may.
Then tell me what your position is as to your right to get these records during those three periods of time, and whether that was an issue at the trial court. I think it's another way of stating Justice Gableman's question.
Okay. If I may, Your Honor, during the pre-48-hour period, there's no issue. I think everybody would agree 236.6 does not apply.
Clark doesn't agree, but we can let that go for the moment. Go ahead.
During the 48-hour period, I would dispute my esteemed colleague's opponent's position. The 48-hour period, that prisoner is not a prisoner, is not under the custody of the federal government. That is a state prisoner. There's a case out of Washington State. It is, I guess I could cite this I would refer, Your Honors, to the fact that every single federal court of appeals that has considered the question of what is the custodial character of an I-247 immigration detainer, and there are a lot of them. I have found 8 circuit courts of appeal, and the Seventh Circuit takes a nuanced position. So 9 circuit courts of appeal. And those are the Second Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit.
But don't all those cases relate to the cases you're about to cite? Do they relate to individuals who are being held on a federal order or a state order? I think it's an important distinction. Justice Abrahamson and I, believe it or not, Mr. Earle, are actually asking the same question. So it's important. These cases need to be distinguished. And my law clerks and I went over this for a great portion of yesterday. If you can cite us to any cases on point, I'm all ears.
Okay, well, Your Honor, I would cite to you Galarza versus Salsec. That's okay. And I'll spell it. S-Z-A-L-C-Z-Y-K. That's at 745 F3rd 634 at page 645. That's the Third Circuit, a 2014 case. Observation that I made in looking at all of these cases, there is continuity between the rulings of all the courts of appeals before the promulgation of 236.6 and after the promulgation of 236.6. And the Galarza case.
What is the holding?
The holding of the Galarza case is that an immigration a person who is denominated an immigration detainee pursuant to a detainer is not a INS, or in this case an ICE detainee.
Okay, all right.
That person is a state detainee, and I have, Your Honor, 8 grounds for why this is true.
Counsel, are those cases applying 236.6?
No.
Okay.
No. And the reason they don't apply 236.6 is because these prisoners are not INS or ICE detainees.
Is it a question of whether they're a detainee or whether they are in federal custody?
Well, Your Honor, Justice Kelly, I don't think there's a difference between if you are a detainee of ICE, you are in ICE's custody. This is like being halfway pregnant.
Well, I'm not entirely sure that's true. So in the Hudson case, the detention was initiated by the federal government, but the person was held physically in the custody of a local governmental entity. Yes?
Your Honor, this is a good point. Thank you for that, for giving me the opportunity to address that, because you're talking about the Connecticut case, or you're talking about the New Jersey case?
Hudson. The Hudson generated 236.6.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And if I may, if I could address the promulgation process.
Don't go to the process just yet. Let's just assume Hudson gave the impetus for the adoption of 236.6. In the Hudson case, the federal government initiated the detention, but the person was in the custody of a local law enforcement agency.
I think that's incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay.
And respectfully, in Hudson.
Well, Hudson was the New Jersey case.
That's the New Jersey case. You had Passaic County and Hudson County, and it was immediately after 9/11. And what had happened was the federal government had rounded up a large number of people after that horrible act on that day. And I guess there were too many people to hold in federal facilities. And the federal government, at that point, the INS, had a contract for services with Passaic County and with Hudson County. And pursuant to that contract, it housed its prisoners there. These were prisoners under the control of the federal government. So when we talk about this distinction between detained and custody, we're talking about, we have to look at it through the lens of control. Okay? If the prisoner is a federal prisoner who the federal government has control over, and the federal government enters into a contract with a local agency, local law enforcement agency, to house that prisoner, and that's what 236 is addressing, then the federal government can impose conditions, including you cannot release the names of these people, you cannot release any information about these people, because and all the county is doing is providing that service pursuant to that contract with the federal government. Because if you were to interpret 236 the way my opponent suggests, you would run square into the 10th Amendment, Your Honor, the anti-commandeering provisions of the 10th Amendment. And that's what the Galarza case addresses specifically. And if I may...
But if that's true, if it's a contract, if it's a matter of contract law, then why did the feds need to promulgate the regulation that came directly out of Hudson?
It happened in the context... Well, Your Honor, they say that. They actually say that in the promulgation process. If I may, I could quote to you from the Federal Register.
But the thing speaks for itself. Okay, so maybe they used a principle of law, of contract law, as a basis for the promulgation, but the fact remains, does it not, that they still enacted the regulation.
They enacted the regulation, but my point with the 10th Amendment, Your Honor, is that the federal government cannot commandeer local jails and make them and force them into the servitude of the federal government.
But it's a request here. There's no forcing. It is requested that you do these things, that you maintain the custody of the subject.
If there is a request that is permissive, every circuit court of appeals that has ever looked at the matter said it is permissive, then yes, that is true. But they're not holding it. Let's go back to the basics in the situation. There were 11 of these prisoners, by the way, because two of the I-247 forms were for the same person. So there are 11 prisoners here that we're talking about. These were state prisoners on state charges in the Milwaukee County Jail. And with regards to the question asked, I believe it was Chief Justice Rogenstack, or perhaps it was Justice Bradley, Judge Brennan was correct. And this court can go to CCAP and verify exactly that Justice Brennan was correct.
Correct, all right, but what?
He was correct that the I-247 forms were served prior to any federal detention.
Prior to the 48-hour period.
Yes, that is.
Prior to the release.
Yeah, but Your Honor, I would go. This is the 48-hour. The 48-hour distinction is a distinction without meaning.
That may be true, but I want to know what the facts were as set forth in the trial court. Were the people that these 11 people were they in the 48-hour period or not when you made the request?
Yeah, yes.
And is that the pertinent time period made the request?
Yes, Your Honor. I made a chart with the name of each subject.
Do I have that chart?
No, Your Honor. Because this is the problem
Mr. Earle, tell me the answer to the question.
Okay.
Which ones? What was the chart? What does your chart show?
Okay, my chart, Your Honor, shows.
And is it all in the record?
No.
I don't care if your chart's in the record. I want to know whether the facts are in the record.
No. No, facts are not in the record, Your Honor. And this is the problem.
What facts are not in the record?
The release date of the prisoner from state custody.
And that was never put in the record by anyone.
Never put in the record, Your Honor. And this is what happens when you have a trial and no mention at all of the of this grounds. My esteemed colleague says it's a new argument. It's not a new argument. It's a new ground. You know, but nevertheless, we don't have a fully developed record on it.
Did anyone go back and tell the trial court that there was an error in the facts? Did anyone ask for a reconsideration?
No.
Not the state, not Mr. Clark, and not you.
But he won. Yes. No.
So let's go back to your Tenth Amendment argument then, because I thought we were getting close to something interesting there. So. Isn't it significant, given your position, that that the federal government cannot simply take over a local law enforcement agency for the purpose of holding these detainees? Doesn't that suggest that they were not actually in the custody of the federal government, that they were in the custody of state government? That was the very reason that they had to adopt 236.6, because they couldn't control the local government. And so they had to pass a regulation that says you can't release this information, and I need this regulation because otherwise you've got control over it, and you could if you wanted to.
That's 50% correct. That's 50% correct. Right? The regulation was not promulgated until after the trial court in New Jersey had ruled that its open records law trumped the objections of the government to the release of the information. So the Attorney General Ashcroft went and promulgated within 5 days, I think it was, an emergency rule, published it in the Federal Register, went to the Court of Appeals in New Jersey and said, we win. We preemption. Right? And that's basically what happened. But that doesn't take away from the fact that these were federal prisoners under contract, who were housed under contract by the county.
They were federal detainees in the Hudson Company.
They were federal detainees. They were federal prisoners. There was nothing state about them.
And there was I assume the federal government paid the state or the county to house federal employees. And that's true in Wisconsin, too, isn't it, that we can house federal employees on payment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said it's not unusual for a state facility to house federal employees or other state, not federal employees, federal detainees or other state convicts if they're paid.
Right. Correct. That's
right.
That's absolutely correct.
So these people in the Hudson County case were being held in New Jersey prison or jail because the federal government asked them to hold them, right?
That's correct.
That's not this case. Sorry. That's what you're trying to say. That's what I'm trying to say, Your Honor.
There's,
say. Okay.
There's
I got
nothing
it.
In common between the 11 people in this case and the prisoners in Passaic County Jail and Hudson County Jail. Absolutely nothing in common whatsoever. Now, Your Honor, I'm going to be running out of time pretty soon, so I wanted to make a number of points, if I may, that I think are important. I think it's very important that this court review the Federal Register and the supplemental information that is provided in the Federal Register about the promulgation of this rule. It will make very, very clear.
You have that in your brief, don't you?
I do, Your Honor, and I'm talking about the Federal Register at 68 FR 4364. And in the supplemental information, it says, if I may read to the court the relevant portions, because I think it addresses what Justice Kelly was asking and what Justice Rebecca Bradley was asking. And that is that the authority of the Attorney General to promulgate this rule, in the words of the Federal Register, plainly authorized the Attorney General and or the Commissioner to set the terms of alien detention contracts to provide by regulation that persons housing INS detainees on behalf of the federal government shall not publicly disclose the names or other information about those detainees. It goes on to say, further, the issue is not whether a non-federal entity consents to the regulation. Any non-federal entity providing housing for federal detainees may take steps to terminate its relationship with the service if it so chooses. The rule simply relieves the non-federal entity of responsibility for releasing information or withholding information regarding the detainees and places that responsibility on the federal government, subject to federal government standards.
Counsel, there's something about this case that bothers me. It's a little different than what you're talking about. I pulled out the matters. Actually, my law clerk did. I have a
you pulled out. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay. My law clerk pulled out for me all of the comments when this rule was being promulgated. And what I noticed from all the comments, and I'll read you one because it tells exactly why I'm concerned. Disclosure of the identities or related information about certain detainees could reveal investigative methods, sources, and witnesses. The detainees could be subjected to intimidation or harm, thereby discouraging or preventing him or her from supplying valuable information or leads. So the purpose of the rule had confidentiality as its focus. Today we seem to be talking about the entity that's supposed to actuate this rule or not. And I don't understand why that should be our focus. Because the purpose of the rule is confidentiality, why should it matter to our decision whether or not it's being implemented through a county that has a notice of detainer, in effect? Why should that matter who has legal custody when the purpose doesn't change? So I think we're not focusing on the purpose, and it bothers me because if, in fact, these folks are being held in the 48-hour period and there's nothing there except an obligation of the feds to pay the Sheriff Clark for their upkeep while they're waiting to take them, and if your request lands there, you don't get the information because now they're holding them as they were in the New Jersey case, and those folks didn't have any state tags. But if your request comes, so this comes on Friday, but maybe your request comes on Thursday, the day before they're going to go into the 48-hour. The policy behind 236.6 is exactly the same. It's confidentiality. How can we honor that policy and treat it differently on two different days? That's what's bothering me, and I don't know how to deal with it. Can you help me?
Yes, I can, Your Honor.
Thank you.
First, the rules are explicit that during the 48-hour period, the federal government incurs no fiscal obligation whatsoever for the holding of the prisoner during that period of time.
I don't disagree.
So that creates a wall distinguishing between the 48-hour period. I was trying to say this case in Clackamas County,
okay.
Miranda Olivares v. Clackamas County case, a federal district court case, found that the county could not say, we're holding these people for the federal government, therefore we're not subject to Section 1983 liability. And the federal court said, no, you are, because you're holding the person. You're not getting compensated. This is not a federal prisoner during that 48-hour period of time. So, that's point number one. Point number two, and the most important point, Your Honor, is that the language that you read about the sensitivity of law enforcement information and the concern about that, that parrots and parallels the language in FOIA for a very specific exception that requires individualized consideration. Now, FOIA, as a result of the Linsmeyer case, I've drawn a blank on the name of the case.
Linsmeyer is right. Go ahead.
As a result of that case, the FOIA exemptions can provide a framework for analyzing whether information should be withheld or not.
Mr. Earle,
Justice Kelly, could I please hear the answer to my question? Just
sure.
One second.
So FOIA can provide the framework for analyzing whether the open records law should, in the balancing process, exempt the information, right? But FOIA is not a vehicle that would go through the pass-through regulation exempting explicit prohibitions on release. And that's an important distinction.
Yes,
right?
Because one is absolute and one is not.
Exactly. And if it's non-absolute, Wisconsin open records law precedent trumps whatever the feds say. And on this record, in this case, after a trial, there is zero evidence to support the applicability of that FOIA-type analysis.
Okay, Mr. Earle, if I could, I'd like you to answer the question I thought that the Chief Justice was asking, which is, why would this information be subject to disclosure on Thursday, but not subject to disclosure on Friday, if that's the dividing time between when the person becomes a federal detainee?
Because federal law becomes operative on that day.
Yes, but
day before. Therefore, that's just the way it is.
All right. Well, then let me take you to the same sentence that I asked Mr. Wistrom about in 2006.
Let me expand my answer to that question, Your Honor. I'll supplement my answer to that question by the fact that the intent of the law makes that clear as well. The promulgation process makes that clear. And the 10th Amendment's anti-commandeering provisions. There's a case involving the Brady Bill, the handguns, and where there were provisions within the Brady Bill that in effect commandeered local law enforcement officers to perform certain functions.
Yeah, hang on just a second, because I really want to get to your answer and your
time. It's discussed in the Galarza case,
Okay, so your time's going to run out pretty quickly here, and I wanted, getting back to the plain language of 236.6 and its intent, that last sentence says, this section applies to all persons and information identified or described in it, in this case that would be the 247s, regardless of when such persons obtain such information. So you're making a very, a temporally very precise delineation between when a person is in state custody versus federal custody. 236.6, and this is the point I want you to address, says that this exclusion from disclosure applies regardless of when the entity...
Apply from when?
This exclusion from disclosure applies regardless of when that person obtained the information, right? So if 236.6 is going to have any application with respect to any of these people at any time, this sentence says, it's exempted from disclosure, doesn't it?
No, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. With all due respect,
I
believe what that is saying is if the request came through on that date, the Friday or Thursday, I guess it was, you know, on the following Thursday or whatever, and the information had been acquired before, at that point in time, the information falls under control. That's what that's saying. It's not saying that the information is under control of the federal regulation before the person became a federal prisoner. What it's saying is after the person became a federal prisoner, even if the information had been obtained by the agency before he became a federal prisoner, that information then falls under the rubric of the regulation. That is what it is being talked about. And there's one very important point that needs to be said here. If Your Honor, if I may, if Your Honor could look at the email from the exchange between Mr. Bilkey and here it is. I got it. the email, I think, between Brandon Bilkey and Captain Trimboli. Captain Trimboli specifically asked ICE, and I'll read it. It says, if your office requests additional information on the I-247 form, it is to be withheld or request the Milwaukee County, this is the critical part, or if ICE requests the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office not to release the I-247 form in its entirety, please provide that information in writing. Right? Not only did ICE never once mention 236.6, it did not respond to that request. It said go. And then there was a dispute between the Sheriff's Office and ICE about nationality and date of birth, I believe. And the county acted in defiance. And this was all open and notorious. It was all right there in the record. And ICE never asserted 236.6 on this record. And there is only one clear inference that this court can draw from that. And that is that ICE recognizes that 236.6 does not apply in this case.
But ICE could be wrong.
Thank you very much.
I could be wrong.
Just a
thank
minute.
You.
I would like to comment on that or ask you to comment. That last sentence, do you have it in front of you, Mr.
I do.
Okay. The last sentence of 236.6 says, this section applies to all persons, etc.
I'm sorry, I didn't have it in front of me. Let me get it in front of me, Your Honor.
Good idea. Here, that's fine.
I got it. Thank you. cover your I got it. I have it in front of me, Your Honor.
Right. It says this section applies to all information. I don't know why you didn't answer that the first part of the section says that this whole 236.6 only applies to a federal detainee in state custody, and your argument here is that these people are not federal detainees.
I think that's what he was arguing.
Well, that's good. Then I understand it.
That is correct. I absolutely.
Right.
Your
red light is on.
Okay.
You have one question?
That's all right.
No. Okay.
Okay.
Here, I'll close this. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think what I heard from counsel is that their position that VOSIS has taken is that even during the 48-hour period that Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office is holding the individual on behalf of ICE, they're saying 236.6 does not apply because they're not technically in federal custody yet. Now, Sheriff Clark is not contending that these individuals are in federal custody before the 48 hours or during the 48 hours. But the focus on whether or not they're in federal custody or not is misplaced. The regulation itself is much broader than whether or not they're in federal custody. And in fact, as Justice Kelly and Justice Gableman and perhaps others pointed out, the Hudson case specifically involved a situation where the inmates were in federal custody, federal detention, but were transferred to a state facility.
Counsel, the issue isn't federal custody. It's federal detainee, isn't it? So why don't we use the language of the statutes and regulations? Is he a federal detainee in the 48 hours or isn't he?
He is a federal, or he or she is a federal detainee.
And is he a federal detainee before the 48 hours when he's in custody in the jail under a state charge?
Milwaukee County is maintaining that individual. So
I want to know, is he a federal detainee pre-48 hours? I mean, you made the distinction, which I think is good. 348 hours, 48 hours, and release. Is he a federal detainee before the 48 hours when he is in Milwaukee County Jail under a state charge?
Let me answer it this way. The regulation doesn't require that the individual be a federal detainee.
Where? Okay.
It says that that houses, maintains, or holds any detainee on behalf of the service. It doesn't say a federal detainee on behalf of the service. It says any detainee. So the individual during that period of time is a detainee, and they're being maintained on behalf of the service.
Counsel, I have a question. Mr. Earle says that ICE has never brought this up. So the regulation, there was a request for assistance from ICE, but they've never asserted 236.6. So if they never asserted 236.6, are we to assume it doesn't apply, or are we to assume, well, I don't know, what are we to do with that? They never brought it up. Do you agree that they didn't bring it up?
They didn't bring it up initially.
Okay.
During the course of these appeals to the Court of Appeals and to this honorable court, ICE has, they haven't actively participated formally, but I've been in consultation with ICE.
Is that in the record?
That is not in the record.
Well, then we're not going to go there.
Counsel, this is follows the question just asked. That is whether 236 applies. You're maintaining 236 applies. Yet, under the plain language of 236, if it applies, you violated 236 by disclosing the names and other information. So doesn't that undermine your argument that it applies? But if it applies, you can't give the very information that you already gave. So tell me why it doesn't undermine your argument.
Well, I think the regulation stands on its own and should be interpreted pursuant to the clear what was anticipated and what the purpose of the regulation was. It should have been asserted. I believe that it should have been asserted before the trial court. I don't believe the information should have been produced. It was. It was only produced after the lawsuit was filed, and again, as a form of compromise, after a hearing was held in front of Judge Borowski.
I don't know how we get into compromises after hearings and stuff. I don't know if that stuff is in the record, nor what you talked about with ICE. Sounds like it's not in the record. So you're essentially saying you really can't explain the conundrum other than it shouldn't have happened.
That's correct.
But what I don't understand is under 236.6, it says held any detainee on behalf of the service. That's in the first sentence. Is it your position that when a person is in county jail under a state charge, that person is a detainee on behalf of the federal government? Is that your position?
I believe the regulation is written broad enough to include that period of time before the 48 hours.
The whole time.
As soon as the request,
the detainee.
The detainer form is received by Milwaukee County. They're then maintaining that individual in part because of the request from ICE. So as soon as the detainer form is received by Milwaukee County, 236.6 kicks in.
If Mr. Clark had released that person by error, he'd not be liable to the feds, would he?
If the individual had been released before the 48-hour kicks in?
Yeah. No, during that 48 hours.
Again, it's a discretionary decision by local law enforcement whether to honor that request or not.
That's right. It's not that he's detained on behalf of the service required.
It's not required, but once they are, in fact, detained during the 48 hours, it's being done on behalf of.
And before the 48 hours, he's being detained only on state charges. Because this is discretionary whether you're going to adhere to this detainer.
But the nature of the information doesn't change. The I-247 form and the information
right.
on it and the need to keep that information confidential
absolutely.
Doesn't change whether it's before or after.
Yeah, but the feds could have drafted that kind of regulation and said that for precisely, and you're saying this does say that.
I believe it does.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. This is a wonderfully interesting case, and it gets more complicated the more you think about it. So thank you very much for very good briefs, and thank you for a very spirited and very, very good oral argument. We are going to take a little bit of a break now so the students currently with us can leave and other students can come in for our next oral argument this morning. So we are adjourned. Thank you.